It's a great pleasure to be talking this afternoon to Professor Lucy Mayer, who taught for 40 years at the London School of Economics and was, in fact, my predecessor there. I've always wanted to ask you, Lucy, how exactly you came to move into anthropology. It was very unknown at the time, wasn't it?
Well, I was appointed to teach international relations, which was also a new subject at that time. And I had a choice in lecturing on the mandate system and the International Labour Organization. And I thought the International Labour Organization is very dull, so I will do the mandate system. And I was already faintly interested in Africa because I had worked as Gilbert Murray's secretary, and he had Norman Lee's book on Kenya, which had only just been published then. And I had read it and been stirred to indignation, as many others were. So I said, all right, I'll do mandates, which were mainly Africa. Now, Audrey Richards was already there studying with Malinowski. And when I said to her that I was doing this African stuff, she said, oh, you can't say anything about Africa unless you attend Malinowski's seminar. So, being always one to do what I'm told, I joined Malinowski's seminar, and before I knew where I was an anthropologist.
We hear a lot about that famous seminar. Who was there? Can you tell us what it was like?
Well, it didn't become famous, really, until after he became an advisor to the African Institute, which was a few years later. At the time when I was there, Maya Fortis had just joined it. Edith Clark was there, but there were a very curious collection of people. I don't know where they came from, at least most of them I don't know. Some of them Malinowski had just picked up at a chance meeting somewhere. There was a lady, Kitty Ritson, who bred dogs, and I saw her name in the newspaper not so very long ago. Allowing for the way the past gets telescoped. There was a man called Avery, whom I always associated with the slicing machines in the bacon shops, but I don't know if that is correct. There was a woman called Gwen something or other, whose great asset was that she had a car, and so could be called upon by Malinowski to ferry her hither and yon. There was a man called Yates, who was practically tongue-tied, but for some reason, Malinowski said, he is the only one of you who understands me. He went to Egypt, but I don't know if he also came from there.
And I gather that most people didn't say very much, they listened. Was that the format, or was there discussion?
No. Well, it's difficult to say. He was at that time writing his article on culture for the Encyclopedia Britannica, and the session would open with his reading a bit of that, but it then did somehow merge into a conversation. And I can't really recall exactly how that used to happen.
Did he have returned field workers at that time? Did he have ethnography from returned field workers or students working under him in the field, or at that time, or was it earlier? It was later that they came in.
His own students reporting on their field work?
Yes.
No, that hadn't started yet.
And was it Malinowski then who encouraged you to go to Buganda?
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, I mean,
the idea of field work, I mean.
It was, I suppose, it was Malinowski who first laid down the rule that you can't be an anthropologist unless you do field work. Oh, yes. Now, this is spilling beans, but in 100 years' time it won't matter. There came a year in which Malinowski was to have a sabbatical. And during that year, whether or not by coincidence, Radcliffe Brown was going to be in London. It was during that year that Fortis and Evans Pritchard became acquainted with Radcliffe Brown and decided that they liked his approach better than Malinowski's. Now, it was only long afterwards that I began to think, but I do seriously think it now, that he didn't want this to happen to me. And that was why he pushed ahead to get me the Rockefeller grant with which I went to the Maganda. Because you cannot believe how Herman Korn is not the word, but it was all personal patronage in those days, so formalities hardly existed at all.
So that if he didn't want you to go, you wouldn't have gone, and as he did want you to go, you...
I would have gone sometime, but this was suddenly sprung upon me. And you can go, I've got you a grant.
So you were sent out of harm's way?
Right.
And how long did you go for?
Only 9 months, I'm ashamed to say.
Well, nowadays people sometimes even go for less, so... But...
Do they?
Yes, I believe they do. 6 months, I have heard.
But then they surely go back.
Sometimes. Were your family very worried about your going to do this? What
did
people think?
My mother was, of course, because... You might say she wasn't happy unless she was worrying. None of the others. When I said to my brother that I was going to go to Africa, he said, they call that the white man's grave, don't they? And no single one of them at any time has ever asked me about anything that I did in Africa.
Very curious. Families are very odd. Did you enjoy the fieldwork? Anthropologists seem to fall into two categories, those who love it and those who hate it.
Well, it depends whether it's going well, doesn't it? It's miserable when it isn't, and when it is, there's nothing like it.
Yes,
and I had a spell in the middle, which was really good. But there I did a truly idiotic thing, which was I had misunderstood a notion that you shouldn't stay in one place all the time because it might not be typical. So when I had had 3 months at this place in Buramesi, I went off to Masaka, which of course meant starting all over again and making friends all over again and so on. And if I had been better at seizing opportunities, it would have been splendid because that was much more backward. You saw... Not that that mattered, we were supposed to be studying social change, but it was, and you saw shrines to the goddess of smallpox and that sort of thing. But I never got a footing there at all, so that in the end I did come back rather miserable.
It's interesting that not so very long ago there was all this to see in Buganda, because recent ethnographers have stressed how very Christianized...
Oh, well, they were Christianized. Yeah. What does it mean, Christianized? I mean, I used to take it for granted, which was very, very stupid of me, but I didn't know quite a short time ago, that once people have been baptized, they follow the whole new creed and throw away all the old one. And that hasn't happened in history, and how could it possibly happen?
I think it's possibly that in the last 40 or 50 years, I'm thinking... of some of the ethnography that came out and some of the historical work that has been done since you worked there, people have been rather concerned to emphasize the way in which the traditional religion disappeared and where the visible signs of it, like the shrines, had vanished.
Well, not so very long ago, someone published a book about Christians in some part of South Africa, and I don't mean Monica Wilson, I forget who it was, but this was about how they all say they're Christians and how they adapt older customs by calling them by different names, and how they gather around graves and call it a dinner when it's just a feast as it used to be. And I don't remember very much detail about that, but it was that that made me realize, well, of course, obviously, that is how it always must be. Now, one of the, I think, a better reason why you don't is that missionary anthropologists haven't been very good at seeing it that way.
That's certainly true. The Baganda have been, I think, difficult to study. Do you remember particular individuals with affection, or
were there particular people? Oh, yes, there was the Dare man to whom I dedicated my book. And it's fair to say, although we didn't call it relying on informants, I relied a great deal more on what he told me than on witnessing actual events. He used to come, and he would come pretty every day, nearly every day, and talk to me. And I was very fond of him.
Did they wear the clothes that have become associated with the Uganda national dress now, the basuti with the sleeves and the wraparound bottom, the women?
You're talking about women?
Yes.
Yes, they did, and I'll tell you something about that. Last time I was in Kampala, when I stayed at the university hostel, or whatever it's called, there was a bunch of visiting Americans there who had seen this garment, and they called it a Mother Hubbard.
Oh, gracious. It was never that.
Yes, they already all wore that.
And so you came back to write up and rejoined Malinowski's seminar.
Yes.
Did you find it different when you came back?
Yes, I think it was. Because by this time, the reporting of ethnography had started, and there was already a form in which people were supposed to present things, and I didn't know about that.
Were there papers that they read to seminars? Nowadays, we make our students read fieldwork reports.
Oh, yes, they did do that. Not necessarily consistently. But you would always, the seminar would be started off with somebody doing something like that. And yes, well, I remember Monica Wilson, for example, giving a very good one. I remember Le Coeur, who was killed with the Free French and so never published anything, producing an African philosophy in which he said they believed in something that they never made explicit. And I said that something which wasn't made explicit couldn't be called a belief. And Meyer barged in with his psychoanalysis and said, of course it could. But I don't believe Freud would approve of the word belief in that context. I mean, in Meyer's context.
It sounds as though you had rather a lively time.
Oh, we did.
Was Kenyatta there at that time, or am I getting my dates wrong?
It was sometime in the 30s, but I think it must have been while I was in the field, because I never came across him.
But some people came and stayed associated with the department, and others came and went. Was that the way it happened? There were some more or less permanent associates of Malinowski and some...
The African Institute people had a year... Now, wait a minute. They had years training before. They didn't necessarily come back.
I see, yes. So there were various different categories of participants in the seminar.
Yes, and then, of course, there were the... Marjorie Perrin came up for a spell and brought with her one or two colonial officials on leave, one of whom was Miles Clifford, whose name you surely know.
Yes, I certainly know that.
He had a letter in the Times the other day.
Oh, did he? I didn't.
A very sensible letter about what to do with the Falklands.
No, I'm afraid I missed it.
Well, he must be about 86 by now. But anyway, Malinowski had... Oh, yes, and there was a man called Harris who became the top man in the Cameroons, whatever the top man was called. Malinowski would have some sort of little, rather jokey characterization of their ideas or of themselves, which he always labored. Harris's uncle was the thing, because Harris had said something about, I suppose it must have been mother's brothers, I can't, of course I don't remember now. I forget what his dig at Miles Clifford was like. There must have been one, or otherwise I shouldn't have remembered.
Was it only the outsiders, so to speak, who got digs at them, or was it the anthropologists as well?
No, I think it was only the outsiders.
And the focus of the department was what in terms of teaching? There were no undergraduates to teach.
There were no undergraduates. And Malinowski, of course, wouldn't lecture as a general thing. I once heard him give a lecture, and I can't think why he gave it. I mean, this is part of the general informality of the whole thing. It was so small, the LSE, at that time.
We forget, yes. So he never, this was one of the very few occasions.
Raymond Firth was on the staff by that time.
Yes.
Well, I was in a sort of ambiguous position because I was already on the staff when I joined. But I was then supposed to lecture in colonial administration. And that meant that for many years I was really dealing just with politics and the transfer of power and all that kind of thing. And it was only after the war, you see, they sent some of the officials in training to LSE as well as Oxford and Cambridge. And this was tried for, I think it was a 5-year period. And then the results were submitted to the elders of the Colonial Office tribe, who said, in London, oh, first of all, of course, they said, now we are beginning to get people from the colonies coming over on these courses. And in London, they will be the targets of communist seduction. So we must send them to residential universities where they will be properly taken care of. So we mustn't send them to LSE anymore. So that was the end of that.
It was specifically to protect them against the left-wing ideas?
No, in fairness, I don't think it was LSE left-wingness. It was just London as such.
Oh, I see. But
not being in, you know, living in places where they didn't have a tutor brooding over them and that kind of thing.
Oh, I see. Not the careful precincts of a Cambridge or an Oxford college. Yes. And Edwin Ardener says that he was one of the first undergraduates to read anthropology at LSE. Is that accurate?
I wouldn't know. Because that would have been, I imagine, during... Yes. Of course, it was after the war that Raymond Firth started to campaign for getting anthropology into the undergraduate syllabus. And first of all, it had to be an alternative specialization with a dozen others. And then gradually it spread its strength until it became a degree by itself.
So it's, when I came to the LSE, it had only recently outgrown sociology, where it was in the Mode 3, if you remember, and had established a specialist degree of its own.
Was it as late as that?
Well, it was a few years before I came, but not long. But when did they appoint Edmund and Audrey? They both taught at LSE. Well, this was much later then, was it?
They did indeed. Now, it must have been when... Now, wait a minute. Audrey was in Wits during the war, of course.
Yes.
And then she came back, and it must have been very soon that she went to McCarrery. I don't know if it was in between that she was teaching at LSE. I think it must have been.
And Edmund?
Edmund also. Edmund had done a few lectures before the war. Very interesting lectures on how the basic principles of mechanics were related to the human form, you know what I mean, doing this and that.
Oh, yes.
So he must have been given a permanent post quite soon after. And then Nadel, of course, also.
Oh, yes, and Schaap.
Schaap was a bit later. Schaap came in 1950.
Some people say that he has made a point of keeping his South African accent.
Rubbish.
That's not true. It was much stronger when he first came.
Well, I don't remember how it... I met him in my very first term because, because there were so few of us, the director used to give a dinner for all the new appointees in any given year, and I sat next to him at this dinner and asked him whether the Africans in South Africa had enough land, which of course was the leading question because I knew the answer.
You say Malinowski and Shapira didn't get on well together. Are you allocating any blame for that?
I would allocate at least three quarters of the blame to Malinowski.
Really? Why was that?
Well, Malinowski was capable of being extraordinarily kind, and we all owe an immense amount to him, but he was also... he had very disagreeable characteristics. He was anti-Semitic, which I suppose is almost natural in a Pole, but he never concealed it, and he used to say most offensive things to his Jewish pupils, there were many. And quite early on he said to Schaap, "Have you ever thought of changing your name?" And Schaap said, "No, have you ever thought of changing yours?"
Oh, lovely.
So then Malinowski said, "How can you, a little Jew, dare to speak to a Polish nobleman like that?"
Yes.
And of course, except in the sense that all Poles are counts, Malinowski wasn't a Polish nobleman.
I can see how he might not have been at all popular, Malinowski, amongst people, if he talked like that. But most of his pupils felt the strength of his personality, whether they liked him or not.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And of course, he was full of ideas, and even if some of them have now turned out to be wrong, it was most inspiring to be in any discussion where he was taking part.
Did he take your material and analyse it, or was he comparing it all the time with the Trobriand?
When you say your, do you mean all of ours or mine?
Either or both.
Well, as far as mine is concerned, he did not look at my material once ever.
And as far as other people?
No, he wasn't always comparing it to the Trobriands. When he generalised about the world, he compared the world with the Trobriands, but that was different.
So you all had two sets of ethnography, your own and the Trobriands?
That's right.
And how did people strike you as young people now compare... as they compare with young students now, more assured, more enthusiastic?
Well, we were all more mature than most, of course, than undergraduates, but I should think probably than most recent graduates too. Nearly everyone had come from studying a different subject already, you see.
And it seems to us now, looking back, that you must have been always the way we perceive you, just as my children think I was always this way I am now. Do you see changes in people you knew in the early days, in character and ideas? Raymond, for example.
It has been said by other anthropologists that Raymond doesn't have ideas. And on the whole, I think I should accept that evaluation. I would say that Meyer became much less socialist as he grew older.
You see, there
Edmund
is something.
Became much more eccentric.
He was less eccentric.
And the first time he really came out, as a maverick, was in that Rethinking Anthropology talk, which was, wasn't it one of the first Malinowski lectures?
Yes, it was. I think the first. Why was there a particular choice? Because you were instrumental in setting up, or one of the people instrumental in setting up the Malinowski lectures, weren't you?
No.
You weren't?
I never had any part in that. I was never on the committee.
I misunderstood that. Do you know how they made the choice? Was there a particular reason to have had Edmund rather than anyone else? It was a great new lecture series.
I can't tell you.
No. It might have pushed him into being more maverick.
It might. Well, he'd already been involved in controversy with Meyer. And so you remember this offensive remark about something that even a professor might understand. That means Meyer, of course.
Yes, we get used to those sorts of things. But did you see much of Evans Pritchard at that time?
No, I never saw much of Evans Pritchard because he had already left the seminar when I joined it.
Oh, I see. We who only knew him when he was elderly find it hard to remember how he must have been when he was young. Was he very different? Was he more maverick than he was in his later years?
I wouldn't say he was anything like as maverick as Edmund. I mean, he was an opposition because he, partly because he was patronized by Seligman, and Malinowski hated Seligman and therefore was prejudiced against EP. Partly he wouldn't kowtow to EP, of course, and Raymond's method, which has been most tactfully described perhaps as agreeing with everyone, was uncongenial to EP, and it led him to disagree more, I think, I don't know whether more than he otherwise would have. But I think that opposition started a very, very long way back.
I forgot, of course, that Seligman was very much in LSE and was the opposite, or the sparring partner or rival to Malinowski. When did he leave? I've forgotten.
Well, he was much older, and he must have left quite early in the piece. And he was, he was nothing like as brilliant as Malinowski, but he was a kind, pacific man, as far as I can reconstruct it. He just let the brickbats be thrown at him and did nothing.
And you said earlier on that you think you were hurried out to Buganda to escape Radcliffe Brown. He then went to Oxford, did he not?
Not until a long time. Well, wait a minute. Yes, you see, it was 1931 I went out, and he only came. You know how peripatetic he was.
Yeah.
He only came to Oxford quite a short time before the war.
But his influence was still very strong on a number of people we think of as LSE trained.
Well, in the end, you see, we practically all went over to thinking that structure and not culture was the thing. Audrey was the only one who didn't, or who thought it didn't matter. I mean, after holding out for years and years, I remember her suddenly saying, structure as we must call it now, without apparently noticing any difference.
But otherwise you were all in some way associated with Malinowski, but used Radcliffe Brown's approach much more.
Yes.
But he wrote so little, it is surprising how great his influence was.
Well, he laid down a few clear principles, and that was invaluable, because what Malinowski did, you've heard of the schemes, I suppose. Well, these schemes were different every time, and of course they were very good for teaching, because they made you think. They were great fun, having different things written up on the board. But as a basis for a theory, they were nothing.
Yes, they have been described, and I certainly was asked to follow them in the field, as useful checklists for field work, his schemes.
Well, that's about what they were, yeah. Well, they started like that. And then, you see, they became a column for institutions this way and a column for needs that way, and that was where they just didn't work.
But Radcliffe Brown gave you some basic principles you could start with analysing your own material.
Yes. Well, the funny thing is, one of the many funny things, all right, you're to go to the Buganda, said Malinowski. You are to go to highly contacted people, because we don't really know enough anthropology to do a really primitive people. Kinship, said Malinowski, would floor you. Well, it was of course kinship floored him, of course.
I was going to say, the pot calling the kettle black. Radcliffe Brown lectured to us when we were first year undergraduates at Cambridge.
Did he?
And he conveyed a tremendous enthusiasm and a great lack of authoritarianism, which we found very attractive. It was not long before he died. Were those qualities he came across with?
I'm surprised that you say lack of authoritarianism. I used to think of him as, and I never saw much of him, but I did think of him as a rather dictatorial person.
He was gentle with our ignorance, I think. That mm-hmm. is what impressed us. We really did know very little. And he was trying to teach us Australian Aboriginal material, which was probably too difficult for us. But
yes,
he was
yes.
very patient, but very enthusiastic. And that was very most inspiring for us.
Mm.
He was more socialistically inclined when he was young, wasn't he?
Radcliffe Brown.
Wasn't he known as Anarchy Brown?
Was he?
Yes, I thought he was a friend of Prince Kropotkin's.
Well, I don't know it. In what years the two of them lived.
Well, this is the myth as I heard it, but he, as far as you know, had no such association with him when you knew him. But Meyer was more socialist, you say, when he was younger.
Oh, yes, I can remember Meyer. This would have been during the war, I think. We were walking along a road somewhere, and the road wasn't very well made, or else we nearly got run over by a car or something, I forget what. And he said, in a socialist government, these things wouldn't happen. And I was already beginning to be rather doubtful whether socialism meant everything being exactly the way you would like it to be. But
this was
the
a bit
kind
hard.
Of thing I mean.
New cadets, as we call them, the Devonshire course, wasn't it called?
That's right, yes.
Yes.
Yes, I think so, but I think they didn't enjoy me. I mean, I was trying to put the African point of view, as you would imagine. And I hope I said, because I always meant to say, it doesn't matter whether people are wrong if they can make enough noise. But at any rate, it came back to me sometime afterwards that what I said was the African is always right.
They must have been rather prejudiced young men, I suppose.
I think they probably were. a lot of them come out of the army, which wouldn't help to make them open-minded.
Did you keep in touch with many of them afterwards? Some of them must have had quite long careers, though others would, of course, have seen
independence. Well, none of them can have had very long careers because the end came so soon. But now, I went out to Nigeria for the long vacation of 1955, which was when the first load of them had been sent out there. And so I did see some of them then, but not no more after that.
How long were you in Nigeria? I remember you're going, but how long were you there? A year, was it?
No much. Well, this time it was a long vacation.
Yes.
And then I went for a summer term when Luca asked me. That was much later.
And you taught there?
Yes.
You've taught in how many places? You also went to Australia to do a piece of research for policy reasons. I mean, policy research, which nowadays we say is so new, but seems to have been done before.
Well, this is not quite correct. When I went to Australia, New Guinea was under military administration, and a civil affairs school had been set up outside Canberra, where instruction was given to the young men who were going to carry on this administration. And I was invited to come and lecture to them. And I went up there the first time because somebody said I'd really better have been to the place if I'm going to hold forth to these young men about it. Well, and on the basis of that, I wrote this book, Australia and New Guinea. And then when I went out there again in 68, I was attached to ANU, and I redid the book just for my own interest.
So you must have been one of the very early anthropological visitors to New Guinea, if it was when it was still under military administration.
The military administration was only because we just got it back from the Japanese. It wasn't because we just discovered it.
Oh, no, but as far as anthropological research was concerned, there was very little except on the fringes, surely, at that stage.
None in the Highlands, but then I didn't get up to the Highlands the first time. I did the second time.
Well, the first time
I went around the coast in a launch navigated by a murderer. Because you know what a nice, polite, and even necessary thing murder is in those parts of the world. He was a charming creature because all the criminals were released in order to have people to work the means of transport. And all the native labor was released because there was at that time a socialist minister of territories who didn't approve of the, what was it called, contract system. And so he said they'd all got to be sent home and then we would start again on a new system. So that really only the inhabitants of the jails were available for any sort of public service.
They had become acculturated while in prison? In some way?
Well, perhaps they had.
Did you find it a very stunning contrast to Africa? I've always thought it must be about as far away as you can go in terms of cultural differences.
Yes, I think you're right. Well, I don't know. I think the PRR may be even further.
You may well be right, yes. The jungle of South America, yes.
Do you find Evans Pritchard?
Well, I saw so very little of him until much later. I was always frightened of his ferocious tongue. But I think it's fair to say that he used it much more behind people's backs than actually to them.
And although there are those who say, I'd never say anything behind your back, I wouldn't say it to your face, I think on the whole, it's better that you shouldn't say these things to people's faces. Mm.
Did you know Max Gluckman at all?
Not well.
Because he obviously had a considerable influence on a generation of...
I thought he had a terrific influence. And he passed on EP's influence, of course. Mm. I mean, I don't know how the Manchester anthropologists are now. I all assume, perhaps wrongly, that they are faithful Max followers. And then Paul Sterling, who's at UKC, well, he just left UKC, he was a Max follower, of course.
I found him rather terrifying figure, Max.
Well,
he was so big.
I know. But of course, you can't really be so terrified of people who are younger than you are.
That's probably...
And then I had Shap, who always used to say, well, I can cope with him because he was my student.
So you were helped?
Yeah. But of course, after he published that thing about Malinowski, I really took against him. Oh, he had vanity in common with Malinowski. I mean, all this reprinting his stuff and saying he was doing it in response to the many demands. Elizabeth Colson, who I think is 10 times the value of Max, always admired him right up to the end, I think.
Well, he certainly made a very cohesive school.
He did, yes.
One of the things...
You must realise, I hardly realise it myself, but it's 15 years now since I left LSE.
No one would guess. You keep up so well.
Well, I doubt it. When I was reading this Perrault article, which is all about semantics and linguistics and metaphors, I thought, good heavens, is that what the subject is nowadays?
Well, I find there are specialisms which I don't really feel I have a proper grasp of anymore, whereas I think as a student... In the 50s, I started in 1950, we were led to believe that we could grasp all of it. And I don't think it fair to tell students that anymore. Some things they may well not be as conversant with as others.
Well, yes, I think you're right, and it is surely better to look at it that way than to say, as I thought was going to be said, you know, here is Levi-Strauss, this is what he says, so let us throw away everything that was said before.
Mm. There are some people I don't even understand anymore.
Yes.
Oh, lots of things that I don't.
I was going to ask you about... You bridged the period of the sort of decolonialisation,
yeah,
of the British Empire. It's often said that the effects of working within a colonial structure invisibly shaped anthropology quite considerably. Do you think, have you noticed a great shift in the period? In
well, I do find that rather hard to swallow. And it goes along with the anthropology, the handmade of colonialism, doesn't it?
That's it.
Well, we certainly, none of us thought it would come to an end so soon. But what we thought was that if we stood up for the natives, which you were still allowed to call them, and say this is what is happening to them and this is what your policies are doing, this might have some influence for the good on policy. I really don't know of anyone who thought it was his business to boost British policy.
So when people had grants from the Colonial Research
Well, that of course, it is so easy to say that the givers of grants must influence the use of them. But this depends on the values of the society at large. We're quite accustomed in this society for people to give grants on merit and let the person go ahead and do the work. And that is certainly what the colonial social science research council did. I mean, I sat on it for a little time when Sally Chilver was the president of it. And we never discussed that kind of thing at all. We would discuss whether this was or wasn't an appropriate subject for colonial office funds. Well, I mean, a suspicious person would say that was a matter of the subject. It was more a matter of the subject matter. I mean, there were some things which could equally well, or perhaps better, apply to some other source of funds, and that would mean that there was more money for the SSRC to play with.
I wondered, Lucy, you've written books on all sorts of topics, on marriage, on witchcraft, on politics. In all your work, what did you get most enjoyment and pleasure from working on and get most excited about?
I don't know what to say. I suppose probably that now deservedly forgotten one that I did before the war called Native Policies in Africa, where I thought indirect rule was the answer to everything. And that's one of the many reasons why I've deservedly forgotten. Yes, I think I did enjoy writing that.
You do actually enjoy writing?
I enjoy writing, yes. I don't write anything nowadays except reviews. But it is just the feeling of putting something into an ordered form, I think, that is enjoyable. And you miss it if you're not doing enough of it. And you miss teaching if you're not doing that either. I mean, people really should do both and not moan that they can't write because they're teaching.
That's
they have to say if they can do some writing.
Yes. So you enjoyed most combining the two, the teaching
yes.
and the writing.
But I am leaving substance aside, I'm sure that I can write well, and I've never really been sure that I could teach well.
Did you enjoy lecturing, or was it, or did you prefer sort of tuition, single tuition?
I think on the whole I preferred lecturing. Yes, in fact, I'm sure I did. Because I know what a tutor ought to be doing, building on what the student has done to extend knowledge and ideas to something wider. And I never really got the hang of doing that.
Jim, period at the LSE did you find the most invigorating? Presumably you were there while Malinowski was professor, and then did Raymond Firth take over from?
Yes. Well, definitely Malinowski's time. Although, well, you know, Raymond was an extremely good seminar leader.
Yes.
I've never known anyone to match him. And how he managed to do it, because I believe he sometimes had a talk with the paper reader in advance, I'm not sure. But he seemed just to pick up the points to take as the paper was being read. And I used to try to do that, and I just couldn't.
Well, he used to wear that pen round his neck, didn't he? And he would... He would always take very extensive notes right through there. I mean, he would pay attention and take extensive notes.
Perhaps he was very good at taking notes in the field, which you also have to do very fast if you want really to have good results.
Yes. When a lot of the most important discussions among the people in departments goes on, not in the seminar, but in Cambridge, it used to be the legendary bun shop, which Jean here used to attend. Was there someone somewhere at the LSE where people used to go? And
well, mostly, of course, it was lunch in the Senior Common Room. And I used to go up there for coffee quite often, but as time went on, people got more and more busy, so that that wasn't an occasion.
But did people go to people's houses? Was there a sort of venue? I mean, was Malinowski very sociable?
Malinowski was very sociable, but in a curious way. I mean, he'd ask so many people, and then either the thing would turn into a seminar, or else it would just be a general hubbub. My father was very anxious to meet him, and what my father always wanted was to ask profound soul-searching questions. I once heard him say to the Webbs, "Mr. and Mrs. Webb, what is your philosophy of life?"
Goodness!
So he wanted to ask Malinowski something like that. And I told Malinowski how much my father wanted to meet him. And so, of course, Malinowski said, "Well, bring him with you in such a time." And it turned out to be this general hubbub. And my father was terribly disappointed, thinking that he was going to have a tête-à-tête with Malinowski. But I don't know. I certainly couldn't have organized that.
I heard from Evans Pritchard that he used to have house parties in Switzerland, is that?
Austria.
Austria.
You could call it that. We stayed at the priest's house, which was about a quarter of a mile, I suppose, from Malinowski's house. There wouldn't be an awful lot. I don't think there would have been more than one or two of us there at a time. There was a time when Edith Clark was staying in his house, and I was at the far house. But I don't remember anybody else being there then.
Mm. Were those occasions when one would have long discussions about functionalism and...
Oh, yes. I remember one time when I said I was going out for a walk, and he said, "And what problem will you think about?" I didn't associate going for walks with thinking about problems.
It was commented recently in a review, or at least in a review I read recently, of his diary, that he had a very considerable ambivalence towards the Trobriand Islanders, the natives. Was there any evidence of this in
Never, never, never. And listen, Alan, if you will look up a fairly recent number of Man in which I had a letter, I said in that letter, "I am astonished to find how many of my colleagues are so saintly as never to have entertained an unworthy thought."
Yes.
Of course, he wasn't sentimental about them, but his main line, the thing which he always plugged, was, "They are just as rational as you are, if only you can see what premises they start from."
Mm. Which is something, of course, that Evans Pritchard also stressed. Evans Pritchard told me that, presumably as a result of this feud with Seligman, Malinowski once said to him, "You will never get a job in the United Kingdom while I live." This was Malinowski to Evans Pritchard. And then E.P. gave one of his smiles and said, "The next day I was simultaneously offered the professorships at Oxford and Cambridge," which is a slight exaggeration.
Yes, but I think that is one of E.P.'s pretty stories. Because he didn't start as a professor at Oxford, he started as a reader.
That's right. Another person who was there when I was there at the same time was Morris Friedman. Did you get to know him at all well?
Morris?
Friedman.
What about it? Are you asking if I knew him?
Yes, did you know him at all well?
He was one of my dearest friends.
What sort of I mean, to me, he was always, he was one of the few people I'd been frightened of, because he was very self-confident, seemed very self-confident, with a slightly acid sense of humour, and I always felt slightly in awe of him. What sort of person did you find him?
Well, it's so difficult. Again, you can't be in awe of a person whom you first knew as Raymond's research assistant. And the first conversation I had with Morris was when I was supposed to have a research assistant in connection with that book on African marriage. And so I asked Morris to come and tell me what a research assistant was supposed to do, because I have never been able to employ others on what I was working at. So that's the first time I met him. Now,
he was a very good lecturer, wasn't he?
He was, yes, very, very good. Mm. And he was very witty. That was one of the nice... He made these lovely puns. Mm.
Yes. It was tragic. His death was tragic.
Oh, dreadful, yes. Mm.
Did you know Godfrey Leonhardt at all?
I know him quite well still.
Because I don't know him well, but he must have been very influenced by Evans Pritchard, I imagine.
Yes, he was, of course. I suppose he was the principal disciple. Mm. Though I have others who, I suppose, you always eventually become ambivalent towards somebody who has dominated you. And I was told that he did by the end. That's not surprising.
You mentioned Meyer several times. Did you know Meyer Fortes at all well?
Very well. Mm.
Were you fond of him?
Were
you fond of him?
Very. Mm. We were neighbours when... not quite when I first lived alone, because I stayed with my horrible family much later than anybody does in these days. But we were neighbours in Bloomsbury, and you know, one of the things about me is that I was never really brought up to know how people behave. And I used to pop in on neighbours without any warning, just when I felt I would like to see them. But it was quite often in the evening, if I had an idea that I wanted to talk about or anything like that. And so I used to pop in on Meyer and Sonia. And that was how it originally started. And, well, I suppose you could just say it went on from there. Mm.
Would you class him as a great anthropologist?
Yes, I would. Mm.
This is a terribly difficult question, but if you had, it's like those balloon debates, if you had to think of, say, three or four of your contemporaries who you think will have immortal status as anthropologists, people will read them in 1,000 years' time when they dig up this capsule, who do you think will be in that category?
Well, I would say both Meyer and E.P. Max, I don't know. I hated Max's jargon so much, but his notion of what he called cross-cutting ties was important. And I've been reading a lot about South Africa just recently, partly because I got some books to review, and they keep talking about Africans, some Africans having been more exposed to urban life than others. It's not a question of being exposed to something. I mean, that's the most old-fashioned cultural rubbish. It's a question of forming relationships. And as I read that, I thought, well, that was what Max did, you know, in his analysis of a social situation. And it was new.
Mm. So the three in the balloon would be Max. You wouldn't put Malinowski or Radcliffe Brown in there.
You said my contemporaries.
Ah. I see.
Of course I'd put in Man and Oscar and Rattle Brown, and since you only asked for four, I could leave out Max.
Were there any people outside the strict sort of small circle of social anthropologists who influenced you much? Any American anthropologists or any philosophers or psychologists or anyone else?
I don't think so. I think I've been much too narrow probably in that way.
Can I say thank you very much indeed, Lucy, for talking to us, and when they dig up this time capsule, they'll enjoy it very much indeed. Thank you.